60 feet above the water. In the dark. With the Germans shooting at you, that was the mission. Not 600 feet, not 60 meters, 60 feet, the height of a six-story building, if you're trying to picture it. If your hand drifted on the yoke at the wrong moment, you were dead before you knew it, and the bomb had to work perfectly, because you were only going to get one pass before the dam wall loomed out of the dark right in front of you. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and tonight we are going to talk about one of the most audacious and technically demanding air operations in the history of warfare. May 16, 1943, Operation Chastise, the Dambusters Raid. Before we get into it, a word from our sponsor. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, commercial, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, back to 1943, by the spring of that year, the Royal Air Force's Bomber Command was deep in a grinding campaign against German industry. The Ruhr Valley was the heart of it. Steel mills, munitions factories, railroads, all of it dependent on coal and hydroelectric power fed by three massive dams. The Moni, the Eder, the Sorp, the theory was clean. Destroy those dams, flood the valley, cut the water supply and the electrical power, and you set German war production back by months, maybe more. The execution of that theory was something else entirely. The Moni Dam alone was nearly 2,000 feet long and more than 130 feet thick at its base. You could not bomb it from altitude and expect to do serious damage. Even a direct hit from 20,000 feet would not penetrate deep enough into the concrete. And the approaches were defended. Anti-aircraft batteries covered the water. Torpedo nets hung below the surface to stop any conventional underwater weapon. Barnes Neville Wallace had been thinking about this problem for quite some time. Wallace was 55 years old and 43, a senior designer at Vickers, and he had one of those engineering minds that treats the word impossible as an invitation to look harder. He had given the world the R-100 airship and the geodetic lattice structure used in the Vickers Wellington bomber, a fuselage design so inherently strong that Wellingtons came home with enormous sections shot away and still held together. Now he turned that same intellect toward the problem of destroying things that conventional weapons could not touch. He did the math on dams. A dam does not fail because something strikes it from above. A dam fails from pressure, water pressure, the incompressible mass of water behind it. If you could place a large explosive charge against the underwater face of a dam and detonate it there, the water itself would amplify the shockwave. The physics were not in question. But how do you deliver a bomb to the submerged face of a dam that is protected by torpedo nets? One version of the story, probably embellished, says Wallace watched a boy skip a stone across a pond. What is certainly true is that he worked out the mathematics of a spinning, bouncing cylinder. If you rotated a cylinder backward at high speed, against its direction of travel, and dropped it from exactly the right height at exactly the right speed and distance, it would bounce across the surface of the water like a flat stone. It would skip right over the torpedo nets. It would strike the dam wall, and the backspin would walk it down the face of the wall as it sank, right to the base. Then it detonated. He called it upkeep. The press eventually called it the bouncing bomb. Wallace dropped test cylinders from a Wellington over the English Channel and over reservoirs. He built scale model dams and laboratory tanks. He ran the numbers over and over, and then he spent a significant part of his time arguing with air ministry officials who thought the concept was either physically impossible or operationally insane, or both. He nearly lost the program on four or five separate occasions. At one point, he was told flat out to drop it.
He did not drop it. He kept showing up with more data. And in February of 43, grudging approval finally came. Not enthusiastic approval, but approval with a brutal timeline. The dam reservoirs needed to be full for the mission to work, which meant spring. Wallace had roughly 10 weeks to go from concept approved to operational weapon. Now, to deliver upkeep correctly, the Lancaster carrying it had to meet three simultaneous conditions. The aircraft had to fly at exactly 220 miles per hour. It had to release the bomb at exactly 460 yards from the dam wall, and it had to fly at exactly 60 feet above the water. 60 feet, sustained, in the dark, over a reservoir in enemy territory. The altitude problem was solved with a solution that is almost beautiful in its simplicity. Two Alda spotlights were fitted to each modified Lancaster, one under the nose and one under the rear fuselage, angled so that their beams converged on the water surface at exactly 60 feet below the aircraft. When the two spots of light on the water merged into a single spot, you were at the right altitude. Simple. The problem is that you are now flying over a German dam at night with two spotlights blazing off your belly, announcing your presence to every gun crew in the area. The altimeter that saves your life is also the beacon that tries to get you killed. For the release range, a low-tech wooden sight was fashioned for each aircraft, two nails set at a specific angle. The bomb aimer lined up the two towers of the target dam through the sight. When the towers frame the nails, you release the bomb. Three variables. 220 miles per hour, 460 yards. 60 feet, miss any one of them, and the bomb fails. To make it work, they needed a squadron. 617 Squadron, Royal Air Force, was formed at Scampton in Lincolnshire in March of 1943. At its head, Wing Commander Guy Gibson. Gibson was 24 years old. 24. He had already flown 72 bombing operations over Germany and more than 100 sorties as a night fighter pilot. He was one of the most decorated officers in Bomber Command. He was also, by the accounts of those who served with him, an intense and demanding man who set standards that were almost impossibly high and who had very little tolerance for anything that fell short of them. He was exactly the right person to lead this raid. Gibson gathered his crews from across Bomber Command, pulling experienced men who had already demonstrated they could keep their composure under pressure. Many of them had no idea what they were training for. They flew cross-country sorties at low level in the dark. They flew over Welsh and English reservoirs at 200 feet, then 150, then 100, descending toward the water in the pre-dawn, half-light with the spotlight system being tested and refined beneath them. Then 60 feet night after night over still water, watching the two spots of light on the surface converge as they descended, then holding that altitude, holding the airspeed, holding everything steady while the dam in front of them in the practice run grew larger and larger. They also had to learn the specific approach geometry of each target dam. The Moni was demanding but manageable. The Eater was something else. It sat in a narrow, twisting valley with forested ridges on one side and steep hills rising on the other. The approach required diving over a ridge, leveling off at 60 feet in almost no time at all, flying the run, releasing the bomb, and then pulling up immediately over the far hillside. Some crews who flew the practice approaches over comparable terrain in England came back and said privately that it might not be doable. On the night of May 16, 1943, 19 modified Avro Lancaster bombers took off from Scampton in three waves. The first wave of 9 aircraft, led by Gibson, was assigned to the Moni and Eater. A second independent wave of 5 was tasked with the Sorp. A third wave of 5 stood by as a mobile reserve. They flew across the North Sea at rooftop height, low enough to stay below German radar, low enough that more than one crew had to pull up hard to clear high-tension power lines crossing their route, low enough that crews reported seeing lights in farmhouse windows, people running out to watch the dark shapes passing overhead. One Lancaster brushed the surface of the Zuider Zee with a rotating bomb, damaged the tail, and nearly came out of the water entirely. Two aircraft were lost before they reached the primary targets, one to flak, one to causes that were never fully determined. Gibson's wave reached the Moni Dam at around 20 minutes past midnight, local time. The dam was lit by moonlight reflected off the water, and the gun crews on the dam walls were alert and ready. Gibson made the first attack run himself. The spotlights merged on the water below. The bomb, spinning at 550 revolutions per minute, was released at the correct range. It bounced across the reservoir, struck the dam wall, sank with the backspin carrying it downward, and detonated at depth. A column of water 1,000 feet high erupted from the reservoir. The dam held. Now here's where Gibson did something that was not in any operational plan. As the second Lancaster lined up for its attack run, Gibson pulled alongside it. On the side closest to the flak batteries on the dam walls, wingtip to wingtip with the bomb carrier, he flew at 60 feet over the water and made himself a target, drawing the gunner's attention away from the aircraft actually making the drop. He did this for every subsequent attack run on the Moni, flew alongside each attacking crew, made himself the decoy, 24 years old over a defended dam at night, deliberately drawing fire. 5 aircraft attacked the Moni. The third was shot down on the approach, the crew lost. The fourth and fifth aircraft pressed through on the fifth attack by Flight Lieutenant David Maltby. The dam cracked. Then it failed entirely. The breach was close to 300 feet wide. The water that came through was moving at roughly 20 miles per hour, and the wave rolling down the Moni Valley was reported at 17 feet high. It roared downstream through farms and villages in the early morning dark. Gibson then led the remaining aircraft to the Eater. The approach was everything the crews had feared. The valley was tight and the hills were close. You had to dive over the ridge, level off in a matter of seconds, fly the run, release, and pull up before the far hillside filled the windscreen. The first two Lancasters made their runs and scored near misses. One crew aborted its run 3 times before finally releasing. On the third aircraft's successful attack by pilot officer Les Knight, the Eder Dam also gave way. Another column of water, another breach, another wave rolling down a valley in the dark. Two of three primary targets in a single night. The Sorp Dam was a different problem. It was an earth-fill construction with a clay core, not the concrete arch of the Moni and Eder. The bouncing bomb was designed for a concrete arch structure. Against earth-fill, you could not apply the same physics. The aircraft that attacked the Sorp flew along the length of the dam and released upkeep in a different configuration, trying to damage the crown. They achieved some erosion of the crest. The Sorp never fully failed. When the survivors of 617 Squadron touched down at Scampton in the gray of early morning, 8 of the 19 Lancasters did not come back. 53 men died. 53 out of 133. That loss rate is staggering, even by the grim arithmetic of Bomber Command's night campaign. The floods downstream of the Moni and Eder killed more than 1,300 people in the valleys below, many of them prisoners of war and forced laborers, with no warning and no way out. The strategic results were real, but also complicated. Albert Speer, Germany's armaments minister, later wrote that the raid had come very close to being genuinely catastrophic for the Ruhr industrial base. His repair crews and German engineering mobilized with extraordinary speed. The dams were patched, the hydroelectric plants came back online. The disruption, while significant, was not permanent. People have argued ever since about whether the raid was worth what it cost. 53 men for a pair of dams that the Germans repaired within months. It is a legitimate question that deserves serious consideration rather than reflexive certainty. What is not in question is what was accomplished in the air that night. Barnes Wallace had invented a weapon that defied conventional weapons logic, argued it through layers of institutional resistance, and delivered it in 10 weeks. Gibson and his crews had trained until they could hold 60 feet above still water in the dark, on instruments and spotlights, with guns firing at them from the structure directly ahead, and release a spinning cylinder to tolerances that amounted to a geometry problem. Gibson received the Victoria Cross. 33 other members of 617 Squadron received decorations. The squadron was officially designated the Dambusters, and that name has never left it. 617 Squadron flies today, operating Eurofighter Typhoons out of RAF Marham. Every aircraft carries the Dambusters' crest, and the motto, Après moi, le déluge. After me, the flood. My sources tonight include Paul Brickhill's definitive account of the raid from 1951, along with the collections at the Royal Air Force Museum at Hendon and the Imperial War Museum in London. If you want to go deeper, those resources will keep you busy for a long time. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Clear skies.